There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. My name is Ant, and I'm here with my two friends, Will and Anna.
Hello.
Hello.
This week, we're talking about the year 1977.
Yay!
Now, let's each of us give our three-word preview of what we're discussing today. Will, you can go first.
Probing every orb.
I don't know what that means, but I don't know that I want it. Anna?
Them Thar Hills.
Them Thar Hills. Ooh. And for me, Disco Darkness Debacle.
Oh.
No hyphens this week.
Disco Darkness Debacle.
Yeah, we're in for a good one. Okay, Disco Darkness Debacle. For mine, we're going to talk about the great New York City blackout of 1977.
Uh-huh.
So have you heard about this?
No.
Why did you make an ooh sound, Will?
Just, Anna made a noise and I wanted to go along with it.
I can guarantee you Anna has heard of this.
I have heard about it because I have seen the movie Men in Black.
And also because there's so little history in America that every little timer event
yeah,
is
blacked out in
note.
The 70s. Is a big deal. Is that true? I bet that's true.
I mean, yeah. You're not so wrong.
This was a major power outage that affected most of New York City from on July 13th. In 1977, the blackout plunged the city into darkness, affecting approximately 9 million people. So, this
wow, wait, there were 9 million people in New York City in
77. Well, that were affected, so it's probably more that
weren't
more affected,
than
I'm
just
guessing.
The city. Yeah. Okay.
And the blackout plunged people into darkness.
It did, yeah, yeah. Blackout, yeah. So the black comes from the eponymous.
It wasn't a white inn.
It wasn't. No, that's Will's social club. Anyway, the blackout.
God. Yeah.
The blackout began on the evening of July 13th when a series of lightning strikes hit power lines and substations in the city, sort of one by one, sort of chain reaction of events. The electrical system, already strained by a heat wave and the high power demand caused by AC and fridges.
Yep, those are the
ice cream trucks.
Two appliances.
Sorry,
in New York.
Ice cream trucks.
Yeah.
Ones plugged into the mains.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, that's how they chill.
There's
chill
actually
the
a city ordinance in New York that every block has to have an accessible plug for ice cream trucks.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Yeah, you didn't know.
Okay,
that.
That's what that plug is.
Surprised you didn't know this. So this occurred at approximately exactly 8:37 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
it's very exact actually.
Yeah,
and by 9:34 p.m. the entire Con Edison system, who were the provider, was shut down. So it was gone. So
in
less than an hour, yeah. Due to, I guess, the angry electrical rays of God, struck down the heathens in New York City. Anyway, the man in charge,
about time.
Abraham Beam, mayor of New York, who was just about mayor by a whisper, who had lost previously and came to power with only 34% of the vote. So, you know, most people didn't want him to be mayor. You got a feel for this guy because, as well as what we're going to talk about, he had to navigate the New York fiscal crisis of 75, which was still ongoing, was when the city nearly went bankrupt. New York was $11 billion in the red. And they had to pull out all the stops. They had pay freezes. They took money out of teachers' pensions.
Classic move.
You can imagine, not super popular. But and they had bond fire sales, effectively.
And they should have set the bonds on fire while the lights were out. It's a good source of illumination from Mr. Beam.
From Mr. Beam, Abraham Beam. But eventually they did get a presidential bailout by President Ford. Safe to say, New York at this time, with its growing crime and drug epidemic, civil unrest, now this blackout and the scourge of disco, was not in such a good way. So considering all of this, how do you think the average New Yorker dealt with the blackout? Do you think well, or B, not so well?
Or B, was it like the Purge?
On a scale of 1 to Purge, how would you think it went?
Like a 9 Purge.
Okay, 9.9.
I think instant zombie film.
Okay, so I'll just give you a smattering of things of what happened.
I think they stored all the bodies in the ice cream truck.
and then they rotted very quickly. So over 1,600 stores were looted.
Yep.
There we go.
Countless items stolen, ranging from clothes, electronics, and notably groceries were stolen.
You got to eat.
You do.
You get those turnips.
Turnips?
No, turnips, that's not really
I'm
a
assuming
thing.
You want to go something...
Turnips are not a thing.
We don't really eat turnips.
What are you talking about? You're a civilized country.
It's an absolute turnip.
I know, I'm just saying, the first time I had a turnip here, I was like, wait, what is this? Is this like just a weird white carrot?
What, you've never had like turnip stew, turnip steaks?
Yeah. Turnip cake on your wedding day.
Well, I guess I will have all of those
turnip
things.
Gyros.
There's something so sad about turnip stew. Anyway, no, so they didn't loot turnips. I can almost guarantee that.
You would go for something dense and like expensive, like cashews or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Macadamias.
Anyway,
over 1,000 fires reported during the blackout. Many started by arsonists who were just taking advantage. The Bronx was apparently hit particularly hard on account of all their wicker houses. I'm assuming. I don't know. I've never been to the Bronx.
No, it's wicker, just wall to wall.
Sounds quite beautiful.
Yeah, it does, actually. It's sort of aesthetically very jarring, but you get used to it.
Oh, lovely.
As a result of this widespread looting and arson, the NYPD arrested over 3,700 people.
Wow.
Making it the largest mass arrest in the city's history and one of the largest mass arrests in the world.
Until they rounded up all the off-brand Muppets in Times Square.
Do you really think there's 3,700 of them?
At least. There's 3,700 off-brand Elmos alone.
Fair. You mean the people that like, are busking and stuff.
Yeah.
I thought you meant just like the characters because Muppets were...
I don't know if either of you have been to New York recently, but there's this whole thing about like... Yeah, it's just like pseudo Elmos in these really janky costumes that they probably bought on Amazon.
Trying to get some cash in.
I don't think Muppet side's a crime, is it? I think it's... I don't think that's...
Yeah, you just take the hand out of the butt and then it's dead.
Anyway, hospitals and other essential services had to rely on backup generators to maintain their operations, and fuel was also getting scarce because they ran on generators. Some radio stations were using these generators to still provide a public service.
Yeah, disco is a public service.
well, they would also, obviously, with the alleviate people's stress with disco, they'd also tell people important information like where the like no go areas were, where the go areas were, etc. And with no power, subways, trains were shut down, stranding thousands of commuters. Many people had to walk long distances to get home, I'm assuming along the tracks, while others slept in their offices or found shelter with friends or family.
Grim.
Yeah, not great. Overall, estimated to have led to about $300 million in damages and lost revenue for businesses, which today's money is about $1.6 billion.
Jeez.
So that's a lot.
How long were the lights out?
Well, we'll get to that. Not all doom and gloom. There was, amid the chaos, numerous instances of people getting together, building these quasi-societies from the ashes of what came before.
It's just, I was just picturing like the Lost Boys, like yeah, people would just paint really, on their faces.
It really and, was. Like, yeah. And they direct traffic, for example, or help each other out, you know, providing like, I guess, milk.
Yeah,
Contraband cashews that have been stolen, turnips, and they made safe havens in the chaos of defending sort of these small neighborhoods and stuff. Also, there was a sort of a joyful story when Rebecca Joy was born by candlelight in Battery Park City. To a chorus of homeless people, I'm assuming.
Did she grow up to be evil?
She did.
What an origin story. Yeah. I was born in the dark.
Her birth made headlines, though, and she became a symbol of hope amidst the chaos. So I actually wonder what did happen to her. And then in some parts of the city, some people threw, I guess, silent discos. The first silent discos, because of the height of disco, obviously. So considering all this, that society basically fell down and New York imploded, how long do you think the blackout lasted? Anna?
So it was long enough for roving gangs of youths to take over, I would say 20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay, Will.
3 nights.
3 nights. Incorrect, 25 hours.
25 hours. Okay, one day. And it happened at night, right?
It happened at night from one night to one period of darkness.
One period of darkness, and then the chaos just continued daylight.
And it just exposed the fragility of the city's infrastructure, highlighted the economic and social disparities in New York City. And in the aftermath, Con Edison, the power company, faced huge criticism for like having really badly configured lightning prone things, electric things, what transformers,
yes,
transformers,
lines,
yep,
exchange interfaces.
Yeah, it was their fault that they let the Decepticons in. They needed better transformers,
And so they had to implement measures to prevent a similar event in the future. And it's just interesting because the 77 blackout is often contrasted with the 65 Northeast blackout, which affected a much larger area, but was markedly more cooperative and calm. You know, the Great New York City blackout of 77 remains probably the most significant blackout in U.S. history and continues to serve as a cautionary tale about the importance of reliable infrastructure, which I'm all for, but also just shows just how this sort of societal makeup that we have. I mean, we saw this with pandemic lockdown. Like, I was out there just stealing turnips and setting fires within minutes.
You did jail time.
You did hard time. Most importantly, though, it's a cautionary tale against living in New York City, which is,
is true.
Garbage town. And I'm on the record as saying
I've been to New York twice, and both times I've not been mugged. But I nearly did both times.
There you go. I nearly mugged someone both times.
So there you go. That is the blackout of 77.
I was excited for 1977. I thought there would be a lot of cool stuff I could talk about. And basically the whole world is my oyster. And I started researching this like plane hijacking by something called the Japanese Red Army. Oh. And then it was really interesting, but I was like, no, I'm tired of talking about
Japan.
Because I've done it once, I think. No, I decided that everybody else gets to do goofy stuff. So today I'm telling you a crazy story.
Okay.
And it's really dumb. It's going to be the dumbest thing I've ever said on the podcast, but it's actually fascinating.
Hmm.
So today I present you.
You are going across a very low bar here.
Well, I set a high bar for myself and I've lowered it right
down. I'm preemptively ashamed of you.
Well, you'll be less ashamed of me when you hear the story of the treasure of Victoria Peak.
Sold.
The treasure.
The treasure of Victoria Peak.
Amazing. I love treasure.
Yeah. Well, get ready because it might be out there for you. Our story today opens in 1937 when a man named Milton Doc Noss is deer hunting in New Mexico. As a sidebar, okay, two caveats up front. One, this is a very long story. I'll try to go through it quickly, but there's so many twists and turns. Two, everyone in the story has an amazing name.
Yeah, so, Doc Noss went on to feature in Fast and the Furious, I believe.
Doc Noss would be such a good name for a villain in the Fast and Furious movies. Anyway, I'm just going to write that down.
Same.
Spec script. So Doc is a somewhat troubled man who's just been released from prison. And he's called Doc because he has an illegal practice as a chiropodist.
Foot weirdo.
A foot doctor. Podiatrist. Foot weirdo. A foot weirdo. Yeah, so he's an unlicensed foot doctor.
And so that's doubly odd.
Yeah.
But can I just clarify? I mean, in a way, aren't we all unlicensed foot doctors?
Yes, but will you, unless I'm much mistaken, don't travel around in a wagon going town to town and looking at people's bunions?
I don't not travel in a wagon looking at bunions.
Every train stop is just a quick setup stall.
Well, then you and Doc Noss have a lot in common. Doc is married to a woman named Ova Noss, who her nickname is Babe. So Doc and Babe.
Egg the babe.
Egg the babe. Noss.
So this is in 1977?
No, this is in 1937.
Okay.
We will get to 1977, I promise.
This is the golden era.
Approximately 40 years.
Yeah, it really is. This is like, imagine like Ragtime playing over everything that I'm talking about here.
Babe Ruth.
Exactly. Yeah,
whacking things. Well, was that how does baseball work?
Whacking things. Yeah, exactly. You're also a little 20 years too late for Babe Ruth. 15 years. Babe and Doc are deer hunting near Victorio Peak, which is in the San Andres mountain range in New Mexico, when it begins to rain. Yes, in the desert. They seek shelter under a rock ledge and discover a cave. Doc, being a sensible, educated man, crawls into the cave and sees a room with writing on the wall. He moves a very large rock, which is absolutely what you want to do when you're in a cave, and discovers a, quote, gaping hole.
Okay.
Yep.
No,
okay.
No questions.
Good. He decides that he needs to spelunk. He needs to explore this gaping hole.
Hang on. Spelunk.
Spelunk.
He sees a gaping hole and he immediately needs to splunk.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. I said what I said.
No.
You can see what she's doing here.
I can see exactly what she's doing here.
Sure, I'm telling you the story of the treasure of Victoria Peak. Nothing more, nothing
in
less.
The only way it can be told.
Yes, in the only possible...
He sees the gaping hole. He decides he needs to spelunk. He goes back to town to get spelunking supplies.
Just like... Lotion, no, rope.
No, stop, rope. And comes back to the cave, descends about 300 feet into the cave, where he finds a room that was big enough to hold a freight train, or what he estimated to be 2,700 feet long.
2,700 feet long?
Yeah, that's
freight
like
train.
Not like a 900 carriage. Meters, I think.
900 meters. Yeah, the whole football, train. Football fields, please.
Football. How many? Is a football field 100 meters?
Yeah.
Nine football fields.
822 meters. 8.2 football fields.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Which is precisely the length of a freight train.
Yeah. So this is where the story begins to fall down. Because if you asked me right now to guesstimate how long something was, I would be off by orders of magnitude. But okay, he said 2,700 feet long.
How are
you
doing?
Yeah. Also, you only ever see...
0.5.
You only ever see a freight train up close, don't you?
Yeah.
So it's a very odd thing to have selected.
I know. But Doc Noss is a man of odd thinking. But instead of a freight train in this cavern, it's full of... it turns out there's not a freight train in this cavern. There is treasure.
What?
It's full of treasure. Stacks of gold bars, jewelry, Spanish-made armor, swords and crowns, statues of saints, and on and on and on.
And is he able to distinguish between Spanish-made armor and other nationalities
he
of
is.
Armor?
He is. In addition to being an unlicensed foot doctor, he is also an unlicensed...
armor.
Antiquarian?
Antiquarian. Armor
okay,
specialty.
So I'm not going to say this is total bullshit.
Yeah.
But it just...
Good, because it's not.
It didn't happen. How did it get there?
Oh, Aunt, how did it get there is a great question. There are several theories. Theory one, it came from Father LaRue, who was a young French priest.
Ah, Babe LaRue.
who was told about the gold in 1797.
Right, okay.
Theory two.
Sorry, hang on, what?
No,
is that the end of the theory?
Don't poke holes in these theories. They're airtight.
There's only one.
Right, okay. So
there's only one gaping hole we're talking about.
Father LaRue.
Father LaRue.
Father LaRue.
Young French priest gets the gold somehow.
Okay.
Theory two. It's from Mexico.
Yep.
During the reign of Emperor Maximilian, who was the puppet of the Austrian Empire.
Mm.
Yeah, but none of these, they're not very complete theories, are they?
It was from collusion between Pancho Villa and Germany prior to World War
I. Yeah, okay.
You talked about Pancho Villa, Will, in a previous episode.
So he was like, okay, we'll come in on your side if you back us against the Americans by providing us with Spanish suits of armor that we can resell for...
Hey, Germany, we'll come in on your side if you give us a fuck ton of gold,
suits of armor.
And suits of armor, there
was
something.
To fight the war? Is it like...
yeah, Spanish-made armor is very good.
Yeah, this is true.
Right, this is a natural place for a sort of funding rat line from Germany to Mexico via this random cave in where again?
New Mexico.
Right, yeah.
So I guess my problem is not with the source of it. Like, I don't necessarily care where it came from, but the logistics of it is what concerns me.
Theories 4-6. It came from the Apaches.
Yep.
Or maybe the Aztecs.
Yep.
Or, of course, maybe Hitler.
Maybe Hitler, yeah. Yeah.
So we all accept that there was definitely gold there, and we don't worry about how it got there.
I'm in.
There Hold on, 19, also, I thought this was 1937.
This is 1937. Hitler existed.
Hitler existed.
Yeah, but, okay, fine.
He had so much gold then, didn't know what to do with it.
Guys, I promise you, this isn't even the crazy stuff. So there's gold. There's also 27 skeletons.
Which, valuable skeletons, though, because they were being paid to buy off the war with.
Exactly.
Okay, fine.
And Doc Noss, who in addition to being an unlicensed podiatrist and an unlicensed antiquarian, was also an unlicensed treasure appraiser because he estimated the treasure to be worth $22
million. $22 million of then money.
Of then money.
$22 million. I'll quickly search how much that was, but that's a lot of
fucking
money.
Now it's got to be like, you know, $80 trillion, I would guess.
No, not that much.
Inflation. Thanks, Biden. he and Ova file a mining claim on the land, basically saying, this is our mountain, we own the rights to it. And New Mexico agrees. So in the month after Doc discovers the cave, apparently he's seen around town with lots and lots of gold bullion and jewelry and the like. He takes one of the skeletons out of the cave because why wouldn't you? And he's said to deposit the gold in various places because at this point in the U.S., it's illegal to own gold bars.
Oh.
You can't own gold bars. You can have gold jewelry, but if you have a gold bar, it's supposed to be.
What if you just
Knox
like dinged
something.
It in the middle until it was kind of like banana shaped, and then it's like gold bananas?
Yeah, it's just my gold banana. That was actually the primary loophole.
It was 120 million pounds worth of gold, by the way.
Oh, that's actually underwhelming.
What? If I came up to you and said, "Do you want 120 million pounds worth of banana gold?" You just turn me down.
I was expecting at least a billion. Anyway, it's a lot of gold. So Doc Noss is taking the gold out bit by bit and he's stashing it around the joint. And he goes down into the cave frequently over the next few years to bring out more of the treasure and he sells some of it. In 1939, he decides to hire an engineer to help him widen the narrow opening so he can get more gold out at once. But the engineer he hired was not a very good engineer because instead of widening the opening, they cause a landslide and seal up the opening instead. Suboptimal.
Extremely suboptimal.
Now the gold's, it's trapped in the cave. Doc does not give up. He tries for years to get it open again. But tragedy strikes in 1949 when Doc is shot and killed with the princely sum of just $2.16 in his pocket.
Well, I mean, in his defense, you probably won't want to carry around all that gold.
Yeah, he couldn't carry the banana gold. It would make his pants fall down. Now, who killed him, you might ask?
Hitler?
The ghosts of the skeletons.
Yep, Hitler, dead for 4 years, pops over from beyond the grave.
Is it Babe? Does she...
It's not Babe, but it is an associate.
Is it the descendants of Father LaRue?
Ooh, that's a really good name for a mystery novel.
He can't have descendants if he's a priest. Oh.
Great point.
Well, I suppose he could be a priest that does have children.
Yeah, he was a bad priest. No, it's a man named Charlie Ryan. Now, Ryan went into business with Doc to find the gold, spending about $28,000 to build an airstrip near the peak so that they could fly in and carry out a bunch of gold. And Doc, in exchange, says he'll give Ryan 50 gold bars. But pretty soon after they make this agreement, Ryan realizes it's all, in Ryan's words, it's all a hoax. He accuses Doc of fraud. He thinks the whole thing is made up. There's no gold. He's just spent all this money to build an airstrip for nothing. This upsets Doc, who fully believes in the gold. And Doc naturally threatens to kill Ryan and his whole family.
Yeah, makes sense.
But Charlie Ryan kills him first. Shoots him in the back, which I think is a bad way to go.
No, I respect that.
Very bad.
So Doc is dead, but Ova still holds the claim, the mining claim on the land, and she's still trying to get the treasure out. But in 1951, who takes over the land? The United States Army.
Oh.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well, here comes a conspiracy.
Here it is. They incorporate Victoria Peak into what is now the White Sands Missile Range.
No
way. I have heard.
Yes, that's where they tested the atomic bombs, all sorts of stuff, because it's in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico. Or did they do it because they knew the gold was in Victoria Peak?
Absolutely the latter.
The army evicts Ova from the area, takes over the lease, and totally ignores all of her attempts to regain access to the mountain. And this is where things start to go crazy.
Oh, gosh.
We're in 1958 now. An Air Force officer named Tom Bartlett claims to have made it into the tunnels while he was stationed at a nearby base. And he even carved his initials onto a few of the gold bars.
Okay.
As a way to say, they're mine, and then I guess just leave them there. So Tom and his friends, one of whom is named Milledge Wessel.
Oh, yes. Milledge Wessel.
Milledge Wessel.
That guy is the kind of guy who would be a ghost in a game and give you a quest.
So Tom
it's
and
true, isn't it? Tom, Monkey Island.
Monkey Island.
Yeah.
Tom and Milledge go to the army and say, listen, we want to conduct an official search. We were spelunking each other and we found gold in this cave. But Ova petitions state officials to make them stop, and they do. But then I guess somebody relents because in 1963, there's another search involving another Air Force officer, this one named Leo Smith, which,
boring.
But he disappeared while hunting for the treasure, and his body was never found.
Ooh. Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay, now we're in the 1970s.
Okay.
Any questions?
Oh, so many questions.
Yeah. Like, why did nobody take the gold?
Well, they tried, but the hole is very small because of the mining engineer.
Not small enough to put fucking 120 million pounds worth of gold down, is it? Also,
like, no, the gold is in the hole.
But if there's
already
100 plus million dollars worth of gold in there,
yeah,
you could hire a drill, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so now we're in the 1970s, famously a time of good decision making in America. There's a very famous American lawyer named F. Lee Bailey, who would later defend O.J. Simpson and also be disbarred for getting high with his clients.
Not O.J. Simpson. No,
I don't think so. Okay. Although it could have been. So F. Lee Bailey says that he represents clients who know where the treasure is. And somehow this comes up in the Watergate hearings because F. Lee Bailey is involved in Watergate somehow. So John Dean is testifying and he mentions this. And so then immediately there's a conspiracy theory that Richard Nixon knew about the gold and was using it to finance the Watergate break-ins because it was off the books and you could just send people in, get a couple of bars of gold.
That's
pay
very
the people.
Off the books. Yeah. It's very,
By 1977, ding, 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 ding. The army, who is maybe sick of all the badgering, relents and allows an expedition to access the mountain. And this is the very creatively named Operation Goldfinder. The people involved include Ova, check. A man named Lambert Dolphin.
Oh, what? Sorry, Lambert Dolphin.
Lambert Dolphin, who is a geophysicist from California who, quote, brought with him a machine best described as a sophisticated cousin of the microwave.
Yeah, echolocation.
Yeah. Those dolphins do have very sophisticated technology. Yeah.
He brings a pod of his relatives so they can echolocate a huge tank of water. So we got Ova, we got Lambert Dolphin. We have a man named Thayer Snipes.
Oh, yes.
This is...
I wouldn't trust any of these fools to go traipsing around.
Are you kidding me? I would trust a person named Thayer Snipes to do anything.
Is this just the results of some fever dream you've had? And did any of this happen?
No, this is all verifiable. So Thayer Snipes is a notorious treasure hunter who has also searched for the lost city of the Incas and the treasure of the Knights Templar.
And damn neither.
He's 0 for 2, but this is going to be his big break. Then there's Joe Newman. Okay, Joe Newman, who's a carpet salesman from El Paso, Texas, who says he represents the Apache Nation's claim to the treasure. No word from the Apache Nation if they sanction this at all. And finally, a man named Norman Scott, a marine salvage contractor and the president of Expeditions Unlimited, who leads the operation. So this ragtag group of heroes scan the mountain. And the radar, or the microwave implement from Dolphin, showed what looked like cave rooms and passageways underground, ones that uncannily matched Doc Noss's old map.
What, a map of a hole in the ground?
A cave. Okay, cave system.
Yeah.
However, no treasure was unearthed.
What a shock.
What an absolute shock. Yeah.
Unless you consider any of the following things treasure. Several empty tin cans. Five sticks of highly volatile dynamite and dirty red corduroy trousers.
Well, I mean, you could thrift them pretty good now. And also, I guess the real treasure was the friends they made along the way.
The real treasure was Lambert Dolphin's friendship. However, there was a torrential downpour during the search, which everyone agreed was virtually unheard of at this time of year.
And would have washed away all that light, buoyant gold.
I'm just saying, it wasn't just New York that God was destroying in 1977. Yeah. Obviously, the story doesn't end there. I swear we're almost at the finish, but there are a couple more twists and turns. In 1978, Floyd Red Nelson, who was one of the searchers, dies under mysterious circumstances in a plane crash. Perhaps to prevent him from revealing the location of the treasure?
Or just 1970s aviation safety.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it was just an accident.
I can't believe this story has infuriated me so much that I'm anti-conspiracy theories now.
I know. I thought you would be solidly like packing up your stuff to go to New Mexico at this point. In 1992, Ova's grandson forms the Ova Noss Family Partnership to finance additional searching, which they have to do. They have to get an act of Congress to get access to the land, and they search until 1996 when the army cuts them off. I already talked about Watergate and that great conspiracy. And finally, there was a guy named Jim, no last name given.
Just Jim.
Jim knew the guy who was helping Doc Noss bury the gold on the night Doc was shot.
Did he?
And the burying guy, whose name is Tom Jolly, apparently had official documents that proved that a treasure existed.
Official treasure documents.
Official documents.
He went to the Ministry for Treasure, filed out the form, waited in line.
He said, this guy who just got shot and I buried a bunch of gold, here are the documents.
What name should we put in the form? Oh, just Jim.
Tom Jolly doesn't remember where he and Doc buried the gold because they buried it at night.
Of course.
It's famously hard to see at night.
And they didn't make a map or a sign or a guide.
No one's careful when they're burying gold.
Someone could have intercepted the map and had just like a straight shot at the gold. They had to obfuscate it.
And there's probably like 2,000 tons of the gold as well, right?
Yeah, so, there's a lot. There's enough gold to fill a tunnel full of a freight train
like,
size.
How long do you think it would take you and a guy called Jim to bury a freight train?
Jim knows Tom Jolly. I can't believe you don't have this straight. It's so clear.
Jim, clearly not able to wield a shovel, but yeah. Tom Jolly, titan of a man, able to dig a hole the size of a freight train in a night.
And what are the dolphins doing at this stage?
None of this. This is terrible.
All of this happened. This is the definitively true story of the treasure of Victoria Peak. And I'm going to leave you with one final quote from Ove Nos, who said in 1977, quote, "I'm not saying that Doc found a lot of treasure, and I'm not saying he didn't."
Oh, but you've led us all in a merry chase, assuming that he did. The government's involved. The president was involved.
The conspiracies go all the way to the top. Gold is absolutely still there.
We should go.
And the entire atomic bomb program was a ruse to cover up the treasure of Victoria Peak.
That
you heard
sense.
It here first. Also, Mark Wahlberg has just produced a documentary about this.
Has he?
Yeah.
Good old Mark.
So there you go.
That's great.
And that is the stupidest thing. I did warn you. That is the stupidest thing I've ever said on the podcast.
Yeah, you delivered.
This is the most angry I've been in a very long time.
Oh, God. I can feel the waves of your anger. Will, do you have something real to tell us? I mean, not that anything could be realer than the treasure of Victoria Peak.
Okay, this week I am going to talk about the Voyager space program.
Ooh.
The Voyager space program.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
It's a thing, and this is a scientific space exploration program. And I'm using the present tense deliberately.
Ooh.
Because the program is still ongoing.
Much like this program to find the treasure of Victoria Peak.
Exactly right.
Slightly more scientific.
And both are working under classified terms directly to NASA, of course. Both the gold.
Yeah, they are at the top of the pyramid. Yeah. We all know
There is gold involved in Voyager, I know.
There is, and I will come to the gold.
Excellent.
Where do you think it came from?
It employs two robotic probes, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and they're not just any space probes. They're interstellar space probes.
Wow.
And that's because one has very definitely left the British solar system, and the other one
has definitely seen the Christopher Nolan movie.
I'm sorry, you said the British solar system?
Yeah. Oh, wait, yeah, I just glossed right over that.
Yeah, exactly.
All part of the empire.
Yeah. Abandoned us in a treasonous act of betrayal. And the other one sort of left, but that depends on how you define the boundary of the solar system. So they were both launched in 1977, which is the year we're talking about.
Yay.
This week. And their mission was to collect data from the planets. So can anyone guess why 1977 was the year that they were launched?
I am going to guess it's to do with the sort of orientation of Earth, such they could slingshot their gravitational thingies around a thingy and then go out the ways they need to do super fast.
That sounds pretty good, and it's probably right. So I'll say something stupid like disco.
Yeah. No, it was Antoine.
Okay.
So one of the big challenges is to ensure you can actually visit most of the outer planets. And at this point, though, it was a really fortuitous alignment in the late 1970s. So it's exactly right. 5 stars.
Yeah, I was in Stonehenge at the time for the Great Alignment.
And so one of the amazing things about the program is that as at the time of recording today in 2026, both probes.
You're in wrong timeline, Will.
Sorry, 2016.
Yeah.
Both probes are still in operation and are sending back useful data to scientists
Really?
Who are, of course, on Earth.
Like, by useful data is like, nothing here.
Beep.
Nothing here.
Beep.
Still nothing here.
No, that's not the data. They're sending all sorts of interesting data about solar wind.
Oh,
and
okay.
All sorts of things. So they're being interesting data coming back.
Still pretty breezy out here, just past the Kuiper belt.
Kuiper?
Kuiper, that's the beyond the Oort cloud, or is it inside the Oort cloud? Oort cloud and Kuiper belt.
You know, we've reached the extent of my knowledge of the Kuiper belt. Stuff.
So one has passed the outer boundary of the heliosphere, and is indefinitely in stellar space, and the other is in the Oort cloud.
Okay.
And is making its way out at slower speed. So this being a history podcast, I'll talk about the history of the program rather than the science of the program.
Both
spacecraft were originally going to be part of an earlier U.S. space probe program called the Mariner program. Huh. And these would have been Mariner 11 and Mariner 12. But then their missions became quite different to the rest of the program, so they got moved to a different one. Can anyone guess the name of the program they got moved to?
Voyager.
No, the Mariner Jupiter Saturn program. And then that was renamed the Voyager Space Program when they redesigned the spacecraft and just like wanted to give it a cooler name.
So the
mission itself was based on an earlier concept from about 15 years before called the Planetary Grand Tour program from the 1960s. And the idea was basically to take advantage of that alignment that was going to happen in the late 70s between those outer planets. And this was discovered by a guy called Gary Flandreau from the Jet Propulsion Lab. And to give you an idea how rare this alignment is, it basically only happens once every 175 years.
Yeah, it's a long time before me and my druid friends can get back to Stonehenge.
So this was far too good an opportunity to miss. And there would always be opportunities to visit the planets later on, but never with so little fuel and in such short time.
Yeah.
They had to go and do something about it. And if you don't know what a gravitational assist is, you have to just like watch it literally any space film because it's
where they slingshot around a planet.
Slingshotting. That's the explanation. We're done. Okay, so there were two probes, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Which one was launched first?
Gotta be two, right?
Voyager 2 was launched first.
We're bad at counting, but we're good at making probes.
Why was that? Why? Just missed a window or something and.
So Voyager 2 headed off on a trajectory that took it past Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And then Voyager 1 got the short straw and basically followed like a straight line all the way directly to one of Saturn's moons, Titan, which might be more beneficial for us in the longer term because that is where there could be interesting living organisms.
Water and such.
Yeah, there's like a dense atmosphere. In fact, there's a probe going there soon, isn't there, to send a snake?
I almost said a human snake. What? Snake?
No, like a snake robot.
Oh, a snake robot. Living snake.
Yeah.
I was like, that seems...
A snakestronaut.
Doomed to fail.
I mean, their spaces honestly, are pretty go, cheap to make.
Going yeah, space, it's just a space sock.
Space sock, really.
Yeah. Google like NASA snake robot. It's kind of creepy, but it's like quite a cool robot. They're building it now. So by going directly for Titan, though, it meant that Voyager 1 had to head away from the elliptical planetary plane. Mm. So that was basically there were no more planets left to see in that direction. And so that was all it could do.
And Alexander wept, for there were no planets to see.
I just want to make a note of that for my sci-fi novel about myself. and William wept.
I can confirm that the NASA JPL snake robot is
cool, right?
Cool and creepy.
Yeah, so really? Creepy.
Yeah.
It's quite depressing to me that could be the first thing that an alien species sees of our civilization is this creepy space snake.
Yeah. Better than a stupid human with its big old face holes.
You're right. We do suck. Okay, so here are a few more fun facts about the missions. So in the 1990s, Voyager 1 overtook the slower deep space missions that had come before, like Pioneer 10.
Deep Space 9.
Deep Space 9. And at that point became the most distant human-made object from Earth. And it will obviously keep that record for the foreseeable future. There was then the New Horizons probe, which was launched in 2006, which had a higher launch velocity, but that's now traveling slower because it didn't slingshot so much compared with Voyager 1.
Is that the one that went near Pluto or something, took pictures of Pluto?
No idea.
How much time did you spend researching the snake as opposed to answering these easy questions?
85-15.
Okay.
Maybe you should just read us a chapter from your space novel instead.
Yeah. Subscribe to the Patreon.
Yeah, I will. I will produce a chapter of a space novel for the Patreon.
Amazing. Good.
Okay, so here's a fun fact for future pop quizzes. So Voyager 1 and Pioneer 10 are the most widely separated human objects anywhere because they're traveling in opposite directions from the center of the solar system.
Human-built objects.
Yeah, they are not human.
I was going to
human being.
Yeah, who drew the really short straw and has to ride Pioneer 10 into the...
Yeah, they're both piloted. By the way, I forgot to mention, both all these probes are piloted.
Just keep going. Keep it steady. Keep it steady.
You're doing great.
God, grim. Okay, so one of the better known aspects of the program is that both probes carry what's called the Voyager Golden Record, which are 30 centimeter golden records that carry pictures and sounds of Earth, including things like Mozart and Beethoven and jazz. Johnny B. Goode is on there.
Johnny B. Goode.
And there are recordings of human voices and animals and all sorts of things. And then on the front, there are these symbolic instructions on the cover that are supposed to instruct a civilization in the future on how to play the discs.
And they sort of look like the instructions you get when you're building a piece of IKEA furniture.
They do.
Right?
Yes, they do.
Like, is it like abstract human shapes and
is, is it like step one, buy a record player?
Yeah. Did we at least send an Allen key with the record?
I'm also really annoyed with them. They didn't accept my SoundCloud rap.
No, I did. Did it not make it on?
No, I didn't make it on, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I keep sending NASA, if you're listening.
So they should have put that on, because instead what they put on, it was in a total act of insanity, was also data in describing where Earth is and where the probes have been launched from.
Why would they do that?
I have absolutely no idea. So this was what went on the discs was decided by a committee chaired by Carl Sagan.
Of anti-human alien collaborators that are trying to get them to come back to us.
So Carl Sagan.
No, I'm happy to banter and joke, but I will not tolerate any ill words spoken about Carl Sagan.
I thought you were against our new alien overlords when they come.
No, or them. And if you're listening, and I think you are, please come, just destroy it all.
So, I mean, Carl Sagan, he's an astronomer, science communicator.
Overrated.
Generally.
I named my cat after him.
No, he's great. He's cool, dude. Good. Yeah,
but
cool.
I mean, I genuinely think he got this one wrong, because if his future civilizations find this probe, we don't want these people coming back to find us, but anyway,
we don't know that. They might be super cool.
No, they're gonna view us as bugs and microbes and just destroy us.
Well, if they're that smart, then they don't need the map. They'll be able to find us.
There was a really good documentary about this. Have you seen The Matrix? We'll just be batteries for them.
No, right, exactly.
I have seen that episode of The Simpsons.
So, and anyway, Carl Sagan. So amongst his many achievements and documentaries, one of his most famous moments came from a documentary that included the Voyager program. And in that, he's popularized what has now become maybe the most famous picture from the missions, the pale blue dot.
Yes. Pale blue dot.
That's great.
Pale blue dot.
It's a very good YouTube mashup kind of video of him given that speech, but to contemporary or through movies through the ages. It's very poignant, very well
done. The speech is incredible.
It is a great speech.
That's why I did get it tattooed on my ass.
Just a pale blue dot.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We should all get that.
Yeah.
So the pale blue dot, for those who haven't seen Anna's ass, was
a vanishingly image, small number of you.
was an image of Earth taken by the probe in 1990 at a distance of about 6 billion kilometers, which is about 40 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And the Earth, as you might expect at that distance, is somewhat small and appears suspended in the refracted light from the Sun in the image. And if you haven't ever listened to that speech that Carl Sagan gives that we were just discussing, you should genuinely jump on YouTube and give it a listen.
It's
tip top.
Yeah, it is good.
So there you have it. That's the Voyager space program.
I think one of the other things he did for the Golden Record is he strapped things to his wife's head, brainwave sensors, and had her think about all sorts of different emotions, like think about love, and she thought about him, and then it took that data and encapsulated it on the record,
too. Okay, so now all the aliens going to know that she was cheating on him.
Oh my God. The slander. I just think that's really cool.
That is pretty cool, yeah. I know. Carl Sagan is a total boss.
Yeah, you're walking on thin ice here.
I really am. I'm sorry, Carl Sagan estate.
Anyway, that's really cool. I think it's one of the coolest things that humanity has ever done, and I don't care if it leads to our destruction.
It kind of does speak to an age of, I don't know, a bit more hopeful and, looking out to the stars and, all that kind of good stuff.
Because now, what would we put on the record now? It would be a bunch of, TikTok clips.
Do you know what it would be? It'd be Elon Musk and his fucking dick rocket just sending up fucking memes. That's what it would be.
True. The universe could use a few more dank memes, I guess.
Thanks for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1977.
All the highs, the lows, the shows, the blackness, the space, and all that's left is to get a new year. So, Will, can you please boot up the random number generator?
I absolutely can. And the last time we did this, because we're recording this end bit,
Yes, we are recording.
So to be clear, the last time we did this, we selected the year 1686, which of course you've all heard already last time.
Yeah.
Because that we had to release the episodes out of sequence. Because, so this time we will select a new year. So that you will hear next time.
Yes.
And
wait, I'm so confused.
Wait,
are they
going
to hear this one next?
At the end of the 1686 episode, did we announce this the next year?
Oh my god.
Are we in a temporal paradox?
Oh my god. Oh my god. We're
okay,
in a loop.
So now we're sort of in this sort of like, what? Okay, I know what day it is now. I don't know necessarily what day those two episodes
hang
are
going. I think we did.
So I think yes, because I talked about the triple the jackpot.
So we've got 777,
which
is the next episode you'll hear.
You'll
and
hear.
Therefore, we don't need to select one this time at all.
It's been selected for us.
It's been selected. You heard it last week, or you heard it in the last episode. You'll hear the 777 episode
in the next episode,
2 weeks from
and
now.
And then we're all back to normal, and we can put this whole palaver behind us.
This whole temporal paradox that I've caused.
And we'll never mess up ever again.
If you'd like to support a podcast this professional... please consider subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/randomlyhistory because we need help.
We really, really need help.
I think we're smashing it out of the park.
All right. See you next time.
Toodle-pip.
Bye.